It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. The first full week of 2019 begins with this More In Monday on the Horn, the seventh day of January 2019. HeadOn.live is where we live. That's where you go if you want to be part of the merry, madcap, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room. Jump on in, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and you will be immediately greeted by the likes of Anatole and Terry and Saigon and VT Blom and Warrior Witch, and more to follow well before the tardy bell that we don't have. Along the way, you'll also be capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, in a stunning display of Spacing Guild Master skills, is both Sparky and Man Cave, having folded space in two directions this evening. And you will also be moderated by pinch-hit midweek utility chat room moderator and all-around great guy Steve from Georgia Stan. A grand time is had by all in the Horn chat. Pop on by. We have thanks to send out to begin this first full week of January. Thanks going out to Kenda. Thank you very kindly, Kenda. Thank you as well to Kevin in Colorado Springs. Thanks as well to James in Illinois. And thank you to Roberto. Thank you all very, very kindly indeed for being partial sponsors of the program. Thanks as well go out to Kim. And thanks to Bob. Thank you very kindly. Thank you as well to Kitty in Boston. I went and visited Boss Man Wayne and picked up the mail this weekend. And what to my wondering eyes did appear? Except a wonderful piece of biography about the American Revolution that I've already begun delving into, and a happening new mug with which I can fill my don't send me emails. I know you all hate decaf, but it's what I've got going for me. My revolutionary roots, Boston, descent is wicked patriotic mug. Via Kitty. Thank you, Kitty, so very, very much. And thanks as well to Laurel there in the frozen southwest Minnesota. Thanks to Brock. Thank you very kindly to Chris in Germany, presently enjoying the daylights out of her Pullmans. Thank you very kindly to our pals at Trendex, and thank you to Alex. Thank you very much indeed. And then as well, we have thanks to send out to James and to our buddy Dr. Allen in Texas and to Reed. Those are the subscribers over the weekend. If you'd like to be a subscriber, you can just run over to headon.live, click on chat, or not chat room, click on the PayPal icon and just tick that little box that says become a make this a recurring monthly donation. If you sign on for $10, you'll be laying out the whopping princely ransom sum of somewhere just a little bit north of 15 cents per hour of programming over the course of your $10 monthly subscription. And one of these days, we will have 400 $10 a month subscribers, and I can quit doing anything except thanking the subscribers. As it stands, We've got about a $300 fundraising goal this evening. We knocked down a whole bunch of the deficit last Friday evening, all but about $100. So thank you very kindly for that. So this evening, $300, 10 at 30, 30 at 10, 1 at 300. That ain't going to happen. 2 at 150, 4 at 75. You know the cipher and me, you know, Gazentas and all of that. But it would be good if we could get a jump on that, because there's about $700 worth of bills that are due this this week. And, oh, they hurts as us. They hurts as us. Mm-hmm. Now, thank you very kindly to Scott in San Diego and to Brother Deacon Asa, letting me know that we are banging on all eight cylinders. Loud and clear aboard the Moran Monday brain train. Remember, kids, it's Totes My Goats Day for Kanye to yell crazy motherfucker a mere 2 months ago as he's tossing Trump's salad in the Oval Office. But it's not okay for a Muslim elected official to say it at some nondescript gathering in D.C. Because standards, because honor and dignitas, right? Yeah, I reckon so. We'll probably be talking about that some more later in the program. But at this point in time, I'd like to get the program going this evening. You may have seen an article in the New York Times regarding some... Well, the headline says, Democrats faked online push to outlaw alcohol in Alabama race. Yeah, did you see that? Did you see that today? Well, it just so happens that because he's a longtime friend of the program, and I mean a longtime friend of the program, and a longtime friend, you know, we grew up a matter of, like, probably less than 200 yards from each other. The guy who was intimately involved with the spoof down in Alabama is actually on the phone with me right now. He's quoted extensively in the New York Times article. And in fact, agreed to be the first media interview that he did on this topic. So please welcome my friend and fellow progressive liberal activist, as well as writer and general... And what shall we say? Knower of the ways and doings of the seedy, sleazy, filthy right wing, white wing out there. Matt Osborne's with us. Hey, Matt.
Hi. How you doing, Bob?
You know, I'm here. Are you there?
I am here. I'm all here and all still in one piece after this hectic day.
I'd say you know, you get quoted in the New York Times, and all of a sudden. There are people out there who are trying to find you. Harumph, he was in the New York Times. He must be worth talking to. Goodness gracious, harumph, harumph. I'm sorry, I don't mean, I'm not downplaying the story itself, but just the way that, you know, the sort of incestuous nature of media, that, you know what I mean.
Yes. Once it's in the New York Times, then it's real news and everyone can talk about it.
Yep. And speaking of, you know, once it's in the New York Times, This little, I mean, it feels like a spoof. I mean, this is a little project that took place back when a child molester was trying to become senator from Alabama, and it's really more than a spoof. It was a sort of an experiment, wasn't it, Matt?
It was in many ways. It was an experiment. My own motivation for getting involved, other than, you know, I will not minimize the fact that I wanted to elect Doug Jones to the U.S. Senate over a child molester, especially, you know, a culture war child molester. That's like the worst kind for me. That was definitely a motivation of mine. But besides that, I was looking to get some data, because we are talking about this since 2016, since November 2016. We are talking about this in the complete absence of data, right? Like, you know that the Russians had a whole bunch of Facebook pages and that they spent probably seven figures on trying to influence American elections. And you're thinking, well, maybe that doesn't sound like a whole lot. Let me tell you, G just $100,000 is a lot of money when you put it into digital. Digital advertising, digital targeting on Facebook, this is the wave of the future, and it is far cheaper and more effective in a lot of ways than TV or mailers or newspapers or radio or traditional forms of advertising. Because, you know, look at how much Highway 31, that was a super PAC that came along to help Doug Jones, right? And they spent something like $10 million in the race. It was millions of dollars. Doug Jones, you know, he spent millions of dollars on advertising. And what did that do to move the needle? It didn't actually move the needle all that much. And you know, if there's some difficulty in determining what moved the needle, right? You see the needle move, why? That's going to be a difficult question to answer. But just look at how much was spent in the traditional media versus how much we spent in non-traditional media, new media. And we got 3 million pairs of eyeballs on our content for far less than you would pay to get that many pairs of eyeballs on, say, your TV advertisement.
Well, and I described it in part as a spoof. And I have from time to time told the members of the Horn Family Community Congregation about what it was like to grow up in Northwest Alabama in and there are people who say, a what county? And a dry county. Oh, you mean you couldn't buy hard liquor? No, I mean you couldn't buy hard liquor, you couldn't buy beer, you couldn't buy wine, and you probably couldn't buy perfume if it tasted good. I mean, the most potable in all of Lauderdale County when I was growing up was the vanilla extract, and they only sold it in very tiny bottles, and it's not very good for doing shots either, for that matter.
And if you opened the store on Sunday to sell it, they would arrest you.
Yes.
Remember, that happened.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So when I described this as a spoof, you had about 2 weeks before the election, the special election down there in Alabama, and you had this $100,000 to spend, and so you sort of brainstormed an idea that you thought would divide pro-business Republicans from the mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking, snake-handling, floor-rolling, Crisco, strychnine-swilling, Crisco-anointing religious maniacs down there. tell people what that theory was, that spoof.
Okay. Now when you say spoof, I think of electronic warfare. Spoofing is where I take your signal and pretend to be you. And
no, I don't mean it in the technical sense.
On your signal.
No, I don't mean that
but
in the technical sense. I mean,
interesting, because there's something to this. Because what we're doing is using actual material against Roy Moore. Okay, this is things that Roy Moore says being used against Roy Moore. Basically, what Dry Alabama was an idea to use the fissure between the business wing of the party, as you say, versus the, I call them the piety Republicans, because this is a divide that has grown up, and it's been very interesting what has happened in the last generation, okay? You had Republicans take over the state, and ironically, part of this Republican takeover of the state is you have business Republicans saying, well, we have to do what's good for business. Business wants alcohol sales. Business wants to have Sunday sales. Business wants us to have, you know, margarita pitchers. So these are things that we should open up because business wants them. And you have the piety Republicans screaming their heads off like, no, you can't do this.
And by piety Republicans, you mean the good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexuals, right?
Well, yeah, but, you know, it's simpler to just say Baptist.
Well, you know,
you know, there's that old joke.
I hate to leave the Pentecostals out in the cold, but,
yeah. Well, see, Baptists are the heart and soul of the temperance movement in Alabama.
You mean not the now, wait a minute. I know where we grew up. You mean it's not the Church of Christ anymore?
Well, the Church of Christ is big in our area of Alabama, our little corner of Alabama. It's not so big in the state. Baptists are the biggest denomination statewide.
And if you look without a doubt.
If you look at the individuals who really put themselves out there as the anti-alcohol lobby. They're all allies of Roy Moore. They're all Baptists.
And they took the bait, hook, line, and sinker, didn't they?
They did. And you have to remember that these are the people that we're talking about here around Moore are folks who are going to be that sort of hardline conservative, right? And if you can show the business-minded, less culturally concerned Republicans that there's a madness there, right, they will be less inclined to vote for that madness. That was the idea. So what we did was we set up a Facebook page called Dry Alabama, which sort of not even tongue in cheek, and you said something about spoofing. We took things that Joe Godfrey, for example, who is the director of ALCAP and one of the Alabama Citizens Action Program. All right. So he's one of these Roy Moore allies that I'm talking about. His own words about alcohol can be used against Roy Moore in this way. Okay. Roy Moore was the subject of a glowing Breitbart article, okay, which went on and on about how he's a teetotaler and there's no alcohol allowed at events where he speaks. Okay, well, then you can use that. So if there's fake news being used here in this program that I'm talking about, it is their fake news. It is not something I made up.
Everything in this experiment was actually sourced to things that that so-called conservative Republicans in Alabama had said or done.
Yes, these are all their ideas that they promote about alcohol. So what we did was we set up Dry Alabama, and we had another page that was sort of an interoperational working there, the idea being to expose as many people as possible to this content. And we've just basically brute force, I call it brute force money bomb. You just buy eyeballs for your content. And Facebook is happy to sell them to you. Okay, it's not like they're going to look into it. It's not like they're going to clear you through some process. Facebook just takes your money, and only a computer ever knows who the hell you are or anything about you.
Kind of like back when you had to go to the Tennessee state line to buy beer. As long as you could get the money onto the counter, they were happy to sell you the beer.
Exactly. So we basically bought eyeballs for this experiment, and we put this content in front of more than 3 million Alabamians. Now, just to give your audience an idea of what this means, okay, to have hundreds of thousands of engagements, that is clicks or comments, and hundreds of thousands of views of your video, okay, what this means is that you are promoting content that is supposed to bring them into conflict, all right? So you have a little fight that breaks out in the comments, like, well, you know, I'm a Republican. I don't agree with this. Well, you know, hey, I absolutely love Roy Moore, and I think we should ban beer. Well, I disagree with you. That's what you want to see, and we started to see that. And what this also means is that you are pushing content that is true, okay, that is not something you invented. Okay, and it means that you are putting hundreds of thousands of people into a mindset where they might not vote. How does this work? If you watch two people arguing about politics, you are less likely to vote. That is a statistical fact. If any two people argue about politics, they are both less likely to vote. It is a statistical fact. So what we do, all right, is show them this content. And if 3 million people see that content, and if we deterred 1%, just 1% of those people from voting for Roy Moore, that is 30,000 votes. Doug Jones won by 21,000 votes.
Right.
Okay, so that's the election right there. That's the whole ball game. But if you say, oh, that doesn't sound likely, this doesn't seem like it would draw off a whole lot of votes, let's say we affected 1 in 1,000 of our targeted voters. Does that sound reasonable to you to just assume that we might have, you know, affected 1 in 1,000 targeted voters? Does that sound reasonable, Bob?
Sure.
okay, that would be 3,000 votes, which is equal to or greater than Doug Jones's winning percentage in 11 of the counties that he won. So, okay, what if you have a bunch of different operations going on at the same time?
See, which there were.
Michigan. Exactly. If you have not just one page, but a dozen pages going, it starts to have a cumulative effect. So we're talking about an idea that maybe you're skeptical. You're thinking, what kind of impact can it have? It has some measure of impact. And when you start adding these things on top of each other, they do have an impact. And we know now, I didn't know at the time, but we were not the only people doing this stuff in Alabama. We now have New Knowledge, which is a company that was doing some shenanigans down there where they had Facebook profiles, fake Facebook profiles, that they were using to try and persuade conservatives not to vote for Roy Moore. And what they were doing was testing out messages. It's interesting. Jonathan Morgan, the CEO of New Knowledge, had some interesting conclusions that he drew from that. It turns out that trying to answer disinformation with information doesn't work. That is not persuasive.
Well, isn't, I mean, okay? not to interrupt, but doesn't that validate something that Karl Rove said eons ago now when he remarked, if you're explaining, you're losing?
Exactly. Exactly. And one of those things that they did was to set up these bots, these Twitter bots with Cyrillic characters in them, okay, to follow Roy Moore. And, you know, oh, ho, ho, look, isn't that funny? The Russian bots are following Roy Moore. That accomplishes three things, okay? One thing it does is it, of course, makes him look like he's got lots of Russian bots following him. The second thing it does is that it dilutes his Twitter power. When you have a whole lot of fake followers on your account, it means that you lose in the algorithms of which content gets presented to people, okay? So your content becomes less visible. And the third thing that you accomplish with something like that is that you get Roy Moore talking about it. Any day that Roy Moore spends talking, complaining about his Twitter account is a good day. He's the one explaining, right? He's the one that's talking about his Twitter account, and Doug Jones is out here campaigning for about real issues and talking about the kitchen table. So new media or New Knowledge, they have denied that all of the things that were reported as being their work are actually their work. I tend to think that they are probably getting pegged with some things that were done by someone else and were sort of swept up into the same report. I think that's quite possible. Of course, I don't know. I wasn't there. I can't say for sure what happened. But I know that this sort of opened up the issue in the last couple of weeks because people were talking about, there's this, you know, shenanigans in Alabama. And I thought about it, and it burned me so bad that this is how it's being spun, right? And Doug Jones is doing what he has to do. Senator Jones is saying, I want this investigated. If any crimes were committed, I want, you know, asses in the sling. Let me tell you, there are no laws violated here. The real crime here, as I just wrote in a post that published at Crooks and Liars about 30 minutes ago, the real crime here is that you can get away with all of this. You can do dark money political spending. There's just no limit to it. You can do these kind of spoofing arrangements on Facebook, and they do not regulate Facebook, and Facebook will not come and find you. They will not stop you from what you're doing. So the moral of the story is that if you think that what we did in Alabama was wrong, then whatever the Russians did in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, that was also wrong, and both of them need to be regulated. I totally agree with that.
And it was doubly wrong because it was a foreign actor.
Yes, exactly. I live in Alabama. Okay, I have the consequences of this race. I live with them every day. I live in them every day. So don't tell me, you know, that I did something wrong or I'm part of the problem. The problem is already there. All right. All I'm doing is exposing the problem.
Right, and you can make an argument, can't you, Matt, that this was really the only way to expose the problem.
Absolutely. I mean, until you have data, it is just an issue that people are arguing about with a complete absence of information, right? And you have political cliques that are arguing about this. You have the sort of Glenn Greenwald, you know, Bernie Sanders kind of clique, and not to cast aspersions on Bernie Sanders, but you have folks who were so mad and Bernie would have won and Clinton was terrible and it's all her own fault. It's nobody else's fault. It's only her fault that she lost, right? They want that to be the narrative. They need that to be the narrative. So they just want to ignore or dismiss all of this Russian election interference. That's extremely dangerous, okay? And on the flip side, you have Clinton supporters who are saying, see, I'm going to get both sides. Clinton supporters saying, oh, well, you know, it was just Russian election interference. We don't have to change anything. Well, that's not fair either, is it? That's not a fair summation of what happened. You need evidence, not looking past the interference or dismissing Clinton as a factor, but saying, what effect did this have?
You're trying to take this out of the realm of faith and belief and into the realm of empiricism and knowledge. Is that fair?
Exactly correct. I wanted to take it into an empirical reality that people could talk about with numbers. And to my delight, there was another actor called Tovo Labs, which appears to have done a much better job of getting metrics on what they were doing. It was a very limited thing that they did, but it was very interesting. What they would do, Tovo Labs would identify a potential Democratic voter, and then persuade them to register, all right? Persuade them to vote. That's a simple thing. That's totally fair. We do it all the time. It's called get out the vote. But doing it electronically on Facebook raised the Democratic turnout by almost 4%. Okay. Oh, well, that sounds interesting. Really, you can do that with just Facebook? Really? I mean, if I went back 30 years in time and told some politician that they could get a 4-point swing just through a Facebook campaign to promote voter turnout, they would say, "Oh, sign me up for that." And if I, could do it for $100,000, they would, even 30 years ago, they would say, "Oh, that's really cheap." And what else Tovo Labs did was they identified two kinds of conservative voters. Again, you see there's a split here. It's something about conservatism that we should discuss in more depth in some future show, but they're not all the same. You actually have divisions there.
Yeah, and it's not a monolith.
Right. What they did was they took the less conservative Republican voters, all right, and tried to persuade them to vote for a write-in candidate, all right? And then they took hard right conservative voters that they identified and tried to show them content of deeply conservative people who were condemning Roy Moore. Ooh. Okay? Do you see how this works?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the results were that the moderate Republicans, their turnout declined, but the conservative, hardcore Republicans, their turnout declined even more. It's more than 4 points. Now, if I went to you just 10 years ago and said, yeah, I can give you an 8-point swing in this election with a $100,000 Facebook campaign, you'd say, gosh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, what'll $200,000 get me?
Right, exactly. So that's what we're left with now. We have finally some evidence, some empirical evidence of whether this works, all right, and how well it works. And those are the two big questions. Does it have an effect? Yes. What is that effect? I would argue that the effect that we are seeing out of these results is big enough that we need to discuss this. We need to have a public policy discussion about regulating the platforms, about what is free and what is fair.
Well, right? And ultimately this goes to a discussion of what speech is protected and what speech is not. But I'd kind of like to back up for a minute, if you don't mind, Matt, and talk for a minute about why Alabama. Because it seems a little bit weird that all of these varied efforts would, but it's not weird when you stop to think that this was a one-off election when nobody else was having elections, and that meant that the entire attention of the nation was focused on this one special senatorial election. Was that why this was sort of independently chosen as the test case?
That is one reason why this became such a test bed. Yes, it was unique in that you had all eyes on this one race. There's nothing else going on. And if you look at the results in the most recent midterm election that we just had, you'll see that party identification just blew all the Democrats away, right? When everybody turned out for the midterm, Democrats lose. What you have in a special election is a somewhat different scenario because it comes down to turnout. You've got to turn out your voters. Doug Jones did an extraordinary job of that. I don't want to minimize what Doug Jones did. Even if he had lost by a hair, it was still an achievement. He really turned out, okay? He was the first Democratic candidate I have seen in a long time who bothered to come to the Shoals. He worked his ass off, and, you know, the victory belongs to him. He got his people to the polls. That made the difference at the end of the day. But, again, partisan identification is such a barrier for Democrats in Alabama right now. So you have a race where you have one candidate, four or more, okay, extremely controversial, which is somewhat analogous to Hillary Clinton, right? Lots of reasons why people who might otherwise vote for a Democrat don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton. Okay? Lots of reasons why people who might otherwise vote for a Republican won't want to vote for Roy Moore. All right? So you're trying out a similar set of circumstances there. And that's one reason why it was a very interesting place to do this experiment. Another reason to do this experiment is because Alabama, if anything, has much lower digital penetration than Ohio or Michigan or Wisconsin, I'm pretty sure. This is not really a Facebook-driven state. Yeah, you've got lots of Facebook users in Alabama. Sure, you've got lots of Facebook users in every state. But it was kind of like running a digital campaign on an analog state in some ways. Okay, so what can you do? That's an interesting experiment in and of itself. So there's a number of things going on. I would even say that just the timing of the election and the way that it got all the attention was itself analogous to 2016. So you have something here. You have an opportunity in which you can test this out and really get a feel for what the results are. All right. Now, again, there are limits to this. Tovo Labs had some difficulty measuring one aspect of the thing that they were doing. All right. We had really good measurements on our reach. Like, we know how many people we reached, but we didn't have good data on what the effects were on them. Okay. But just establishing that $100,000 gets you a huge Facebook campaign in Alabama. Just establishing that, you know, engagement tactics will reduce turnout for your opponent by 4% and increase your own turnout by 4%. That really tells you something about how these technologies, how these tactics work. They actually do work. They have an effect, and that effect does seem to be enough to make a difference, especially in the most marginal races. I would not expect someone to want to use these tactics in, say, a race where it's Democrat plus 16 or Republican plus 15, right? That's not going to happen. I cannot win that race for you with any amount of digital advertising. I can get you closer, right? But I can't win that race. Where you want to throw this money in, if you're looking to put money into a digital disinformation campaign or engagement campaign or disengagement campaign, you would look towards a race that is Democrat plus one, Republican plus two. That's the race where you want to throw in a lot of digital money. And I will predict, your listeners can write this down and they can look to future elections to see whether I'm right about this. I predict that the closest races are we're going to see the most digital money in the years to come.
Well, based upon what you've described, it would seem to be only common sense. But something else that struck me about all of this, Matt, is that it tells us something about the digital impact, but it also says, it also confirms to me something that it seems like various corners of the American political community have known for a long time, and that is, you know, there's hard voter suppression and there's soft voter suppression.
Yes.
When, for instance, and we saw this, say, in 2000 and in 2016, and we heard it in 2008 and 2012 to a certain extent as well, but it didn't come into play. And it goes back to 1968 with George Wallace and 1948 with Strom Thurmond, when they would say things, and it usually goes like this, and I have to do my Southern accent for it because that's the way I hear it in my head. There's not a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. George Wallace campaigned the daylights out of that in 1968 and 1972. I think Strom Thurmond did the same in 1948.
Yep, he did.
And what that does, and when, for instance, Ralph Nader in 2000 says, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, and when it gets said in 2016 as well, what that serves to do is to demotivate the Democrat.
Yes. Demotivation is a big part of this. And demotivation becomes easier when you have a controversy such as, oh, well, that's a centrist Democrat. I don't vote for centrist Democrats. You know, we're seeing this right now. Like, one of the responses that I got on Twitter today from a fellow named Dan Cohen, who, by the way, you know, he's a correspondent for RT America. Okay. Him saying that I'm a disinformation warrior while he's working for RT America.
Yeah, that's a little funny.
That's just really funny. That's hilarious. But he says, well, this might sound radical to centrist hucksters like you, but maybe if Democrats ran on a progressive platform, they wouldn't have to use dirty tricks.
Yeah.
Okay, you are welcome to come to Alabama, sir. You are welcome to run for Senate here in Alabama with the most progressive platform. Go run for dog catcher in Alabama with that platform. I want to see how that works for you. I dare you. I triple dog dare you to come down here and do that. Go on, put your money where your mouth is. Show me what you got.
Right, and that's, you know, that's a central tenet of things that we talk about here on this program, Matt. And that for instance, the Democrat who can run and win in Southern California probably couldn't get 10% of the vote in a Mississippi or an Alabama. But the same thing is true conversely. The Alabama Democrat, yes, would probably be to the right of a California Republican.
Yeah.
These are simply political realities.
Yes, and the insistence on heterodoxy, on orthodoxy, all right, that is really damaging to a political movement. And so, you know, I like to look past that, and I like to say, what can we do now? Well, one of the things that we can do now is, hey, you know, if they're not going to pass laws or regulate this, let's do digital campaigns. Because the other side is absolutely doing it. I guarantee you they are doing it. I guarantee you they did it in Alabama. I know for a fact that Steve Bannon, okay, he was Roy Moore's buddy, all right, I know for a fact that he does digital campaigns like this. So, you know, tell me, do we fight this with one hand tied behind our back? Do we put out one eye while we're at it? Maybe cut off an arm just to make things fair for Mr. Conservative? I don't know. I don't know that that's, you know, the solution. I think it's better to come from a position of strength. I think it's better to have Doug Jones in the U.S. Senate saying, we need hearings on this topic. I think it's better to have Democrats running the House when you're talking about this stuff, because that way, okay, maybe you can have a conversation based on the empirical evidence, first of all. And then when there is legislation, it will be actually aimed at, you know, solving a problem for both sides rather than trying to gain an advantage, which is, you know, what I see arising out of this. You have this New York Times story today. Suddenly, you know, you've got Fox News, a screaming headline, you know, fakery. Okay. Like there's never been Republican fakery before.
Well, as if right? the term rat fuck didn't arise out of Republican politics in the early 1970s, for Christ's sakes.
Well, there you go. That's another example right there.
I mean,
been going on for decades.
Yeah, I mean, what we're talking about.
Supposed to push back?
What we're talking about is digital rat fuckery, which is an outgrowth of the old hard, if you will, hard copy analog rat fuckery at which the Republican Party is and has long been past masters.
Right, like, you know, you've probably seen direct mail campaigns that made you go, what?
Yeah, the classic
what agenda is behind it.
The classic historical example is Edmund Muskie and the so-called Canuck letter.
Yeah, that's a perfect example.
I mean, there were no computers involved with that. That was just one skeevy Republican operative, one typewriter, and then getting the for-profit media to go along with, oh my God, Edmund Muskie shed tears. He must be a homosexual. I mean,
yeah.
this has gone on forever. And yeah, my antennae are constantly up on this. And frankly, I'm seeing, you know, because I don't have the massive followers that other people do, but I can watch a Twitter feed and tell when I'm being manipulated, or at least sense when I'm being manipulated.
All this manipulation is going on all the time, and it's not just politics. Social media manipulation is just a big deal generally. And we're going to let it affect our politics? Okay, well, you know, if we're not going to do anything about it, then I'm going to do it too, right? Like, oh, well, now it's happened to you, so now you're upset.
Oh, well, you're not going to be ideologically pure if you do that, Matt.
Well, that's always a problem. You know, there's always a critique.
Well,
you've become part of the problem.
Let me ask you this. We know that in states that are heavily controlled by Republican majorities, Alabama, Mississippi, et cetera, Wisconsin, we know that they have engaged in hard voter suppression with things like voter ID laws and shutting down polling places. I mean, anybody who follows the news knows what's going on.
You require an ID, and then you shut down the place to get the ID. Real simple.
Yeah.
Real simple.
And then you make sure that the polling place is a 250-mile round trip for people with no driver's licenses.
Put it outside the town limits, like where was that? That was
Kansas.
Dodge City. I think it was. Yes, Dodge City, Kansas. Yes. You put the polling place outside the city limits, you know, across a six-lane highway. Yeah.
So in states, and Alabama, again, is a good example, in a way, doesn't it work sort of as a wash when you compare the amount of voter suppression that is targeted primarily toward the African-American community, and then you...
Yeah, see, this is a legitimate question.
Yeah, it is.
Our Facebook campaign, did it have an equal or greater or lesser impact compared to the impact of voter suppression on the African Americans who tipped the balance for Doug Jones? You tell me. I can't tell you the answer to that question.
I can only guesstimate that it had some impact, Matt. If only because of this, and I do not mean to take anything away from the brilliant get out the vote effort that was made. Okay, let's have that on the front end.
Well, let's just establish that right there. Yeah.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, Doug Jones's margin of victory was roughly equivalent to the number of Republicans who voted for a write-in or a third party, or you get the idea.
Uh huh. Was our Facebook campaign, was it equal to, greater than, or lesser than the impact of write-in candidates? There's a good question. I don't have an answer.
And I don't know how you begin to get one of those, because you can't go behind the curtain in the polling place, or even more difficulty, you cannot determine who did not go and vote because they could not go and vote, or because
right.
they had been suppressed
right.
from going and voting. You can only do some sort of statistical analysis on that, unless I'm completely missing it.
You're absolutely correct. These things are hard to measure. That is partially the point here, is that because these things are hard to measure, we tend to operate, again, in a kind of vacuum of information, right, where the answers to these questions are whatever we feel. Okay, well, I'm a Republican, so I don't feel that's a problem. I'm a Democrat, so I feel that this is a problem. Do you see how that works? And this arrangement works out in favor of who? Who does this work out for? It works out for people who sell their services to politicians running Facebook campaigns. It works out great for them. It doesn't work out very well for democracy. It doesn't work out very well for progressive activists. It doesn't work out very well for progressive politics. Okay? It works out great for the consultants.
Well, those are the entire for-profit American political system is run almost exclusively for the benefit of the consulting class. It's a life support system.
This is true. And one of the things that I liked about doing this was that I didn't have to work for a consultant. If I wanted to get experience, on a political campaign, an outside political campaign, wasn't doing it with a consultant.
Well, so then let me ask you this, because it seems, you seem to come down on one side here. Do you envision some sort of statutory or legislative effort that could take this out of play? And if you do, what does that look like? Because
There are a few things that we can talk about. Absolutely. Okay, France. They have a law in France that shuts down media discussion of election-related things 48 hours before the election is held. Okay? Similarly, it would not be hard to regulate Facebook that, you know, political pages or pages appearing to aim at, you know, changing political views. Those pages should not go up within 30 days of an election. Okay? We literally got the money at the last minute. We were the dog that caught the car. 16 days before the election, okay, here's your money. Go do your thing. Oh, wow, let's get to work. Okay? So that, A, that limited our influence. That limited our impact. But B, that shows you just how much of this actually takes place very close to the election. You know, it's within about 35, 40 days that you get decisions about, okay, well, I'm a billionaire. I want to throw money into that state right there to try to elect that person. And so the timing of the decisions comes at the end. It would be interesting to have a discussion about regulating dark money in that way. Also, dark money donors, just require disclosure of dark money donors. All right. If we're not going to do the thing that's already in the law, that is black and white, that says no political spending by nonprofits, if we're not going to do that, then let's do something about making sure that it's not mysterious who that is. it would be fine with me. We're
make everybody operate out in the sunshine?
Exactly. You know, if you see a Facebook page that confuses you, Dry Alabama, you know, you should be able to click on that, say, who is this person? You should easily be able to locate information. But, you know, things have gone in the opposite direction. If you go to the Federal Election Commission's website right now, looking for 990s, or excuse me, the IRS. If you go to the IRS website looking for nonprofit 990s, you can download one big, huge, enormous PDF file of all of them. You don't get to find them. You don't get to search anymore like you used to. They've made it much harder to use. They've made it a giant pain in the ass. That's the opposite direction we should be going. We should make it easy for people to locate information about political spending, about political speech. It's fine. You want to speak. You want to do XYZ. That's fine. You say XYZ. But who you are, whose money you represent, should be perfectly clear.
Well, let's be clear about something, though. I mean, I'm not contending with you. I'm trying to flesh this out.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say political organization A. They've got an executive director, and they've got a secretary treasurer and a 32nd degree vice president. and they've all got disclosable salaries. But you want to find out where the money comes from, and you go digging around, and all you can find is a post office box somewhere in Los Angeles.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This is why it needs to be regulated. There needs to be a discussion of how we make it possible, make it easy to locate the sources of the speech. It's like, okay, you want to say that money is speech? Fine. Okay, then money is speech. But how is it anonymous speech? Why should it be anonymous speech? I don't think it should be anonymous. And, you know, you have folks like the Mercer family who come along and say, oh, well, you know, it's terrible the amount of social opprobrium that we get for our spending. Well, you have been spending money in order to promote neo-Nazis in America. Yeah, you might suffer a little opprobrium for that. That might be appropriate to what you just did. All right? We have to accept that. We have to accept that, yeah, you know, George Soros money behind something is going to, you know, oh, George Soros, right? You're going to have that.
Baruga, baruga. Yeah.
Exactly. But at the same time, do you really want the Koch brothers spending all that money, billions of dollars, on our elections just wholly unregulated through dark money nonprofits? I don't think you do.
Well, let me ask you a question from the real world. Is there some way, with the story that broke today in the New York Times, I mean, you're like I said, you're quoted extensively, Matt. Is there some way that you could have protected your identity? And that this could have just come out as a sort of anonymously performed experiment, because see that's the thing.
Well,
you're out in the real world and your name is splattered all over the New York Times, and I gotta be honest with you, Matt. I know what the White Wing is capable of. I know what they do. They run up, you know, Nazis run over protesters at protest events and so forth. I'm a little worried for you.
Don't be worried for me, Bob. I tell you this much. I took steps years ago to try and keep people from being able to find my physical location easily. All right. I took those steps many years ago. So I've always been kind of a privacy nut, and I'm not really worried for myself. I'm much more worried for America. I'm much more worried for democracy than I am for my own skin. But to answer your question, it would have been impossible for me to go on the record without giving my name to a reporter, because the professional journalist does not do things that way, right? The paper of record is not going to have an anonymous blind quote sourcing a story like this, okay? The only way that you're going to get a blind quote in the New York Times is if there are two other sources confirming what you say. And that's an interesting thing that your audience may not be aware of. If you read something in the Washington Post or the New York Times, I'm just talking about these two newspapers, okay, and there's a blind quote, meaning a quote by an unnamed official close to the situation or unnamed White House official or something like that, it means there are two other sources that are confirming their version of events, okay? I did not have that. And what happened here is that I essentially approached the reporter and made this story happen. And I tried to minimize the blowback on people because I understand that, you know, there is a reason why the folks that I did this with, why they were not wanting their names out there. But in the final analysis, I care less about them than I do about democracy. And this whole thing with new knowledge, okay, and Jonathan Morgan was just being spun all backwards in the news. It was important to me that we got a different story out, one where, hey, you know, I don't see a crime here, and I don't see anyone who can point to an actual crime that has been committed. I only see basically an imitation of the tactics that were used in 2016. And if you hated them now, but you didn't hate them then, or if you are concerned about them now, but you weren't concerned about them then, that speaks to hypocrisy. You either have to be worried about this topic or not. Either this stuff works or it doesn't. There's no you can't have it both ways. You can't have it each way according to whether it benefits you or not. It's got to be sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. That's the only way that this works.
But you know, as long you do realize that the white wing operates on the better mousetrap theory of operation. In other words, if somebody comes up with a better mousetrap, they will work at being better mice.
Yes, I fully expect, actually.
Or the burglar lockpick analogy. As quick as you invent a better lock, you get a better class of lockpick.
I imagine there are lawyers, you know, on the Republican side who are reading this New York Times article and saying, now how do I set up something like this? You know, even better, even more secretive. You know, there are obvious limits to my ability to, you know, do a thing that I hate in order to make money. But I fully expect that there will be some Republican in my email, in my DMs, somewhere soon, saying, "Hey, would you like to be paid consultant? You know, tell us about this stuff." I fully expect that.
The funny thing is, before you actually said that, I was thinking about James O'Keefe.
But yeah, a nemesis of mine from way back.
And this is, and the rat fuckery of 2016 just exists on a continuum from him, and Acorn, and Shirley Sherrod, and in other words, in 2016, this did not appear out of nowhere. This is the ongoing effort to build the better lockpick, to be the better safecracker.
Yes, it's an arms race, and it will be a runaway arms race unless we put on some brakes.
Okay, again, Matt, that's going to require legislation, and let's be a little sober here. I want the House to do a lot of dynamic stuff between now and 2020, while Mitch McConnell just sits there and says, so that come 2020, there's a clear choice about do we want this country to be able to do and be something, or do we just want to be the country? But in the interim, nothing is going, there are not going to be any meaningful, there's not going to be any meaningful legislation passed between now and November 3rd, 2020.
Yeah, it's gonna take another cycle at least.
Well, you you got the better chance in November 2020 because you got 20 Republicans and 13 Democrats up. I mean, witness the fact that the Cory Gardner in Colorado is the new Joe Manchin, the most vulnerable man. Well, Cory Gardner is running around now saying, you know, we really ought to open the government and fuck the law. And that's because, you know, he can feel the hot breath on the back of his neck and is at least spending some time contemplating what it means to not be a senator anymore. But that all being the case, do you have any, because you spend a lot of time with social media and electronic politics, do you have any suggestions for how people can guard against being influenced by this stuff?
Well, yeah. First of all, listen to your instincts. If there's something tickling at the back of your mind that says, you know, maybe I should check that out, listen to that instinct, okay? Do check it out. One of the things that we saw in 2016 is that Russian operation had these profiles that were used to contact, you know, American voters in various ways, through pages, through private messaging, to all different kinds of techniques. And, you know, this attempt to reach us involved stolen identities, okay, which is just kind of bizarre. You don't really have to go that far with Facebook. I mean, really, you really don't. You just need to have an IP address in the United States. But, you know, what they sought to do was to divide the left, right? To promote Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton as a totally unacceptable candidate, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay, it's fine to feel that way, to not like the centrist candidate who wins the nomination. I get that. Okay. What I don't like, and what we should not like, what we should collectively dislike, is letting people do that so loudly and vociferously and not ever question them, like, you know, who are you? So be a little more skeptical. Also, if you see paid or promoted content that, you know, may feel like it's aimed at you, okay, it probably is.
And you're seeing that. And now paid and promoted content is at least marked as such?
Yes, yes. At least it is marked as such. And you should be skeptical about it. You should wonder what that is and who's it from. Like I said, one of the reasons, you know, one of the things that I talked about a minute ago was making it easier to find out who these people are. I'm talking about in that situation right there. It should be easier for you to say, hey, you know, who is that bunch doing that ad? I would like to know more about them. Okay? So be skeptical about what you see. Be inquisitive. And don't be afraid. I won't say, you know, don't go reporting every single thing on Facebook to Mark Zuckerberg. This is a Russian. This must be a Russian. Don't do that.
You do that almost as well as I do.
Do be unafraid to report something that is suspicious. If you don't want to report it to Facebook, report it to me. You know, someone like me would be happy to look into it for you and maybe write about it. I've done plenty of that. I've had people come to me in the years past and say, hey, there's this thing I don't understand. Can you tell me who these people are? And I go and look into it and I find out what's going on and I write about it.
I know this is true because
that
I've done it.
That has happened more than once. So what?
I said, I know this is true because I've done it.
Oh, see, there you go.
but you're one guy. Is there a need for some sort of, because granted, our side has moved by fits and starts, and sometimes it seems we're terribly one foot in a bucket about it. But, you know, Media Matters sprang up years ago to highlight the sleaze that happens over in, you know, white-wing broadcasting. The Right Wing Watch does a brilliant job keeping up with the hucksters and the scammers of the religion industry. Does somebody with deep pockets out there need to found and fund a clearinghouse for this kind of bullshit manipulation?
I first proposed this idea in 2012, Bob.
I know.
I have been talking to people about it ever since, and I'm still waiting for some liberal billionaire to come along and say, you know, maybe that's a good idea.
You know, hi, Mr. Steyer.
What we have on our side is that our billionaires listen a lot less, and they are a lot less courageous.
Yeah, I know. I was just saying, hi, Mr. Steyer. You spent a blue bajillion dollars on your move to impeach ads, and how about actually helping the American voter?
Yep, there you go.
Because with the time frame we've got between now and November 2020, I recognize that the House may find it necessary to impeach, but I do not harbor the illusion that Mitch McConnell is going to let the Senate convict.
No, because he's complicit.
And so with that in mind, how's about we try to do our best to make it as possible as it can be to oust Donald Trump from the presidency? Okay, we're just everybody else has heard this except you. I have this dirty little fantasy. Robert Mueller continues to do his work. And, you know, because of the way the Supreme Court is constituted and because there's a guy sitting on the Supreme Court who is specifically put there because he feels like the president is above the law, Robert Mueller, maybe let's say he comes up with some really good reasons to indict Donald J. Trump. And he does what the conventional wisdom says he should do, and that is keeps the indictment under seal. So we cruise along to 2020, beat Donald Trump like a barred mule, and then, just right after the new Democratic president's hand comes off the Bible, a couple of FBI agents show up next to Trump and say, sir, come with us. Slap the cuffs off and perp walk his crooked speed freak ass off into his long... gray-barred retirement.
What a delightful fantasy that is.
Isn't it? but having some way of being able to spot when we're being manipulated, it might come in handy along the way toward that moment.
It very well might. We do need better tools. There's going to have to be some activity in secret. Someone is going to have to come up with tools that they can basically bust out during the height of the election season, pulling the curtain aside and showing what is Russian influence, right? This is what Russians are doing right now. This is, you know, what they've been doing for the last 6 months. Here's what we think they're going to be doing in the next few weeks, and then follow through on that. You know, here's what's been going on in the last few days. Here's what's going on tomorrow. Because I think we need to have a sense of what the IRA and what those guys in St. Petersburg are up to.
Yeah, see, I'm easily confused. I'm so old, I remember when IRA meant Irish Republican Army.
Me too.
Every time I see it, I have to go, Internet Research Agency. but you're right in that regard. So all things being equal, one of the metrics for me of the success of this of these Alabama operations and how much it tells us is the fact that what a week 2 weeks ago I saw a press release from some Russian press outfit saying, oh, Mother Russia did not interfere in American election. Here it is. Here is proof. Americans interfered in American election, and pointing to the Alabama stuff.
Yeah,
it's like,
well, you know, that's
subtlety is not their strong suit.
Yeah. Somehow, us doing this in 2017 was the real problem in 2016. I don't know where I got the time machine. I'm not sure how this works.
Yeah, you don't.
Temporal distortions. It's a Star Trek plot.
Yeah, well, that or Bullwinkle, you know.
I'm flying around in a TARDIS. It's not a voting booth. It's a TARDIS.
I really appreciate the time you spent with us because this is a huge story.
I really appreciate your having me on because I think it is a big story that people need to know about.
You know, and not just because people played head games with the poor Atne Ute Aitbre, if you one what I in me, wing nuts in Alabama, but because this, well, I'll say it. I think this was a patriotic act.
Thank you.
Because somehow or another, we needed to know empirically what this stuff looked like. And thus far, we haven't gotten that much of it.
That's why you have people angry about it, right? That's why you have some people are angry about it because they didn't want there to be any metrics.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's an entire phalanx of people out there who have been hollering, there's no Russian interference all along.
Yeah.
And they're heavily invested in their personal need for there not to have been.
Exactly. Exactly.
Whatever the cause of that personal need, it may actually be.
Well, I thank you for having me on, and I am going to call it a night because my phone is beeping at me that it's about to die.
Well, I hate it when that happens. Plug up the phone, get some rest. Tomorrow may be another day in your 15. I'm not being a bastard when I say your 15 minutes of fame. I'll ask you before we go. Would you object to testifying before Congress?
Hell no.
Well, that's the mark of a truth teller in my book. Matt Osborne, thanks for what you did. Thanks for the time you spent with us. Take care. And as a dear friend of mine says, watch your back.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye now. Matt Osborne, you can find him on Facebook and Twitter. And let's see here. Let me do this and then this. And go ahead and read the New York Times article, but run over to Crooks and Liars and check out the post that he put up, that Matt put up about everything that happened. I suspect most of that got covered in the last hour. But there is a reason, and we didn't go into it as deeply as maybe I might have liked. But our fetishized approach to the First Amendment, as it presently exists, is going to pose a huge, huge barrier against being able to do anything substantive about all of this. Facebook has a lot of money and a lot of influence, and they're going to resist being regulated. So the best defense against all of this stuff is to be your own ombudsman, be your own filter, be skeptical. And like Matt said, if you see an ad on social media, whether it be Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or any of the others, and you wonder, why am I seeing it? It's probably because it was targeted to you. Because the difference between, say, traditional media, you remember the ads that were being run during the election cycle that were run primarily on African-American radio stations talking about how, who was it wanted to abort all the babies? Remember that ad? It was odious. It was disgusting. Well, that's about as close as you can drill down in traditional for-profit media, is to run ads on radio stations or that cater to a specific market. But with social media, they can drill down all the way to you. And that's what makes it so much more effective, and that's what makes it so much more dangerous. So we have to be our own individual guardians, and we have to be willing to call out this kind of bullshit when we see it. I saw the dry. I follow a bunch of Alabama stuff on my on Facebook, and I saw that dry Alabama ad come up, bing, and I went, "Well, this is just crazier in the head than the hog is in the ass," and it looked like a joke. It looked like it wasn't real. But maybe that's because my bullshit detector is a little bit more finely tuned. So, before anything else can happen, we have to be individually active in our own rights. And by the way, we're into the second hour of the program, and I have thanks to send out. Thank you very, very kindly. To Catherine. Thank you, Catherine, so very, very much for jumping in this evening. Catherine just took us down from our $300 fundraising goal to $250. And if in the next hour and 45 minutes we can raise another $250, whether that's 25 people at $10 or 10 at $25, in the grand scheme of things, when you think about the for-profit media, like I said, we run this conversation for very, very little. So if folks would like to help out, it is help that is badly needed, because like I said, there's about $700 in bills that have to be paid this week. Okay? So go hit the PayPal button if you would like. Oh, let me have a look. Let's see. Let's take a quick look here. Hey, let's run over to the phones. Apparently, this made the little hair stand up on the back of Scott's neck. Hey, Scott.
Well, no, wait a minute. You are presuming
that there are little hairs on the back. Yes, I absolutely am.
You're ahead of me again. Damn it. Well, it just raised a couple of questions. And I saw the item on the New York Times website. But I didn't read it. And I don't know why I didn't read it. I guess I had other stuff to do, but I will read it. But my questions that have arisen, I have two of them. Did I understand Matt correctly that there are no effectiveness results to come out of this experimental project?
No, just that you can't get that granular. Or they weren't able to. But they can hypothesize things like 4% swings.
Yeah, but a hypothesis has to be based on something.
It's based on the data that they received. But you cannot say, no, this specifically in, you know, Joe Smith over there was specifically influenced by this ad.
No, I'm not even asking for anything that granular. I'm wondering if I understood him correctly that they don't know whether it was effective or not, but they can guess that it was, or they suspect that it might have been. Did I hear that correctly, or am I misinterpreting?
No, I think that's pretty close to fair.
Okay. Because, see, the reason I asked that question is, and then I have another question. But the reason I asked the first question was, you've obviously heard of the late, great David Ogilvy, who was in the 50s and 60s, one of America's, and 70s even, was one of America, if not the world's, premier advertising gurus, David Ogilvy.
Yeah, founder of what, Ogilvy and Mather?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he didn't found it, but he ran it. Oh,
okay.
I guess he did. Found it in a way. There was a version of it in Britain, and when he came over here, he basically established And then later, I think they became connected. I haven't read his book for a number of years. But the reason I bring up the name of David Ogilvie, and you can find some of his videos on YouTube about some of the concepts that he was big on when he was kicking ass and taking names in the world of advertising. One of the top three or top five rules that were like unbreakable if you wanted to do it the Ogilvie way was you must be able to measure accurately and realistically what impact your ad had and be able to track it to get whatever it is that you're selling on behalf of a client.
Right, which is kind of interesting, Scott, because you know from having had a broadcast background that the most you can do is make hypotheses about the effects of something like Arbitron or Nielsen.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about ratings. I'm talking about tracking the effectiveness of advertising, which in effect is what Matt was doing. He placed an ad with an aim at a specific group of people or consumers, if you will, or actors, if you will. And according to Ogilvie, you've got to be able to track the effectiveness of the ad. That was the first question that I had. The other question is, having a left-leaning or left-wing or progressive entity engaging in something that we have decried being done by Republicans, doesn't that kind of kick the legs out from under us in terms of being able to point out their malfeasance or their ne'er-do-well?
Oh, you mean the yeah, y'all did it too theory?
Yeah, because you know that's what they do. The double standard.
I've been watching social media on this story all day long because I knew that I knew since yesterday we were going to be having this conversation, and I've actually known about this whole thing for months and have kept my mouth shut.
Okay.
The Wambulance was cranking up and Republicans have been crawling up on the cross all day long because of course they're victims.
But what is our side saying about it? I don't personally.
Well, I mean, Doug Jones says he wants a full federal investigation. And you are what Matt said. He will happily sit down with anybody that wants to listen.
Well, that would make for some interesting testimony. And I'm going to read the piece that was in the Times because, you know, my gut reaction is, you know, how can I accurately decry the activities of another person that are not positive or appropriate when I've started to engage in them myself.
It was not engaged in on the scale that the Russians engaged in it in 2016. This was more in the way of an experiment. It's not like Matt's going to go and be part of another effort to do this.
Okay, I get that, but then we've got to talk about degrees of sin, if that's the justification here, because, okay, you've slept with your wife, with someone other than your wife 100 times, and that makes someone a bad person. Well, Your Honor, I only did it once. Well, the fact remains, if it's established that sleeping with someone other than your wife is inappropriate and not positive, 1 or 100, it doesn't matter how many times you did it. It's not the degree of the sin in that case.
Well, you look at it from a standpoint of sin. I look at it from the standpoint of somebody who's interested in the acquisition of empirical data, because it didn't exist.
I'm not casting the first stone here. I'm only wondering if this is the right way for us to go, especially with such a pivotal election coming up in less than 2 years. Do we really want to go down that path? Because...
Well, I think one of the things that Matt pointed out is whether we want to go or not,
we're on it. And it's like there's a wall that follows at our backs, and all we can do is go down the path.
So we have no choice, is what you're saying.
No, I don't think it's a matter of have no choice. You know, this was not about saying, let's all go do this now. This was about saying, for God's sakes, let's learn how it's done. Let's see what it does. Let's see what kind of an effect and impact that it has, so that we can go out there and warn people against it. I mean, Matt didn't come on here, Scott, to brag. He came on here to try to ring some damn alarm bells.
Okay, and I get that. I do get that. And I'm not throwing stones at you or Matt or anybody else. I'm just wondering aloud.
I get that. You know, I get that.
Because you've dealt with them probably longer than I have, by some measurement, or in a different way than I have. But I've watched these fuckers. Did I ever tell you the first bet that I ever won?
No.
It was in 1960, and this, I will invoke the name of my late great, great Aunt Emma, whose birthday, by the way, was on January 4th, a day that I hold in much reverence. She would have been 139, so wherever she is, I hope she's brightening up people's days the way she brightened up mine. But anyway, we used to get on the bus when I was just a mere prat of a child, and go down into downtown Alexandria to a 5 and 10 cent store called G.C. Murphy. I don't know if they had them as far south as you grew up, but they were based in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, and they were kind of an East Coast.
Oh, I know Murphy Mart. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think they ran those as well, trying to emulate Kmart. But anyway, we would get on the bus, 10 cents a piece to ride the bus, go downtown, and while she sat in the back chatting with her blue-haired friends, I would run rampant in the store, bugging the ladies at the record counter or the little display that spun around that had magic tricks or whatever. But anyway, she was good friends with the manager of the store. And we ran into him one day in like October of 1960, and she engaged him in conversation. And along the way, he asked me, who's going to win this election that's coming up, little Scotty, all of, I guess, 6 years old in 1960, Richard M. Nixon or John F. Kennedy? And I knew that there was going to be an election, and I knew Kennedy was a Catholic. And I had seen pictures of Nixon, you know, I saw what a shifty bastard he was. So I said, well, I'll bet that Kennedy's going to win. Well, a month out from the election, it was anybody's guess who was going to win. And we shook hands on the bet. And then in November, I collected my dollar and probably bought a record, a 45 or a magic trick. But anyway, I say all that to say this. I've been following politicians to one degree or another for a long time, and I've seen over time we've peed in our well, okay? I say the collective we, the system has, the well has, the political system in this country has become peed in, and yet we still expect to get fresh drinking water out of it. And it just troubles me. Lord knows when the other side does it, and greatly troubles me when they use a foreign government to engage in it on their behalf, and by their behalf, I mean Trump's behalf, okay? And I just get a quiver, a nervous quiver when we talk about our side going down that path, because that way lies even more pee in the well, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So I hope we can learn from this.
Well, if you heard what Matt said, Scott, we premised a lot of this on my hypothesis that, sorry, we're not going to be passing any laws and getting them signed by the president between now and 2020 to deal with this issue.
No, but well, first of all, you'd have to get it through both houses of Congress, and you know the sugar plum fairies would fly out of my ass in formation, singing sweetly a song from James Taylor albums from the 70s, before we'd get something like that through Congress, because they don't want anything that's going to improve things. They want to keep the status quo, so to speak. So, I mean, you get let's say they did get over that hurdle. You're right. Trump wouldn't sign it. He would conveniently mislay his magic marker, his Sharpie, or whatever he signs that scroll with. Has a handwriting analysis done a study of what passes for his signature?
You mean that electrocardiogram?
Yeah, it looks menacing, and not vaguely menacing. It looks like, damn, what's going? What are the?
It looks like it was written by a hand that was wrecked out of its grip by Adderall. That's what it looks like. It looks like the signature of a speed freak.
Well, there's that. But I'm thinking that the snakes in his head are making him write that way. It just frightens me when I see it. So, but anyway, it was a good conversation. I'll listen to it again on the replay in case I missed anything, and also check out the source article in the Times, because I saw it.
And there's a link to a previous article the Times had reported about one of the other efforts in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, what was that? What was that about? Was that another?
Well, yeah. I mean, Matt referenced it. There were multiple groups doing something similar, only different, in Alabama, like the other effort that had Cyrillic Twitter bot accounts with Cyrillic names following him that made it look like he was being followed by Russians.
Yeah.
To make him freak out about his social media presence.
And I do get the Rovian technique of, if you get them explaining, then they're not effective or they're losing. Because if you get them off message, and that's the other thing. Do we want to give these people more ammunition to use to try to get us off message?
We get off message with such ease and aplomb that I don't know how you would measure that. I mean, a newly elected Palestinian American member of the House of Representatives used the word motherfucker to describe Donald Trump, and I could stand out on the back stoop and hear the millionaire for-profit media pearls being clutched from 300 miles away.
No, it's worse than that, Bob. If you stand out on the porch and listen, kind of cup your ear a la Gary Owens, you will hear the sound of pearls being restrung. They've been clutched so damn much in response to motherfucker.
And of course, because this hits kind of close to home, the fact that my senior senator, Joe Manchin, took it upon himself to apologize to the nation on behalf of everybody because Rashida Tlaib used a word that Trump has probably used more times than she has in her entire life, by a factor of a billion, it was just embarrassing. There's nothing like watching Joe Manchin go off on a mansplain.
Well, I don't want to play "Can You Top This" in the waning moments of this call about senators in our home states, but did you hear what one of my senators did the other day?
Oh dear, no.
And I give you Dianne Feinstein, who I like. I don't like everything about her, but I like her as a general rule. She was talking to somebody and made it fairly clear that at this point in the proceedings, she thinks that Joe Biden would be a nifty candidate to run.
Well, that's because she thinks he's a young whippersnapper.
Well, I guess in her world, he is a young whippersnapper, you know? But in the real world, and I'm not discounting any goodness that resides in the bosom of Joe Biden, but I can't help but wonder if perhaps his opportunity has passed and he would do us all better and himself a good bit of good to...
Well, maybe I'll piss people off by saying this, but it bears reiteration, I suppose. I am opposed to all septuagenarian and or octogenarian and or nonagenarian candidates for the presidency of the United States. Back to that notion of empirical data. We've got empirical data on at least two presidents and how inadvisable it has been to have a septuagenarian in office. Granted, they happen to be Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, and both Republicans. but still, I mean, there are just physical realities that attach to such a choice. And yeah, if it's Biden or if it's Bernie, a big deal will be made to show how vigorous they are. Well, a big deal was made to show how vigorous Reagan was, too.
Oh, I know.
He said in that debate with Mondale, well, I promised I wouldn't hold his youth against him. And, oh, didn't the millionaire for-profit media just think that was dorling? They did.
They yucked it up.
Oh, he was the great communicator now, wasn't he?
Was that at the Kansas City debate?
I don't remember where. The only specific location I can remember Reagan showing up at was at the home of the Klan.
Well, the reason I asked about the Kansas City debate, my radio station sent me there to grab tape for that, and I wasn't in the hall, so I didn't actually see it. I was downstairs in the press room, and that was exciting. That was a long fucking time ago. That was 1984, Bob.
Yeah, well, yeah, and...
Let me sit down. I've been walking back.
That was the first presidential. That was the first presidential election in which I got to actually vote.
84.
Yep.
Ooh.
Because I was still too young. In 1980.
Oh yeah.
Didn't turn 18 until 1981.
Yeah, my first time was in 72. Boy, that was a fun night. As I recall, one of my coworkers and I sat on, we got in her car and we drove up to behind the Masonic Temple on the hill in Alexandria, smoked a big old fat doobie, and then came back and sat on my front porch swing, weeping bitter tears as the election numbers came in. Everybody went to bed early on election night in 72.
By the way, we've had a note from Darlene in Connecticut. Darlene says, I was conscripted into reading Fear by Bob Woodward, long story, and let me assure you, Trump says the word fucking with such reckless abandon, I can't even tell you. I think he's outpaced only by Steve Bannon.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But yet he stood out there in the Rose Garden or where the hell ever, and he said, I think she's dishonored herself, and she's dishonored her family.
Of course, of course.
Shut up, motherfucker.
They grab him by the pussy in chief. Boy, that's a source you can rely on if you want to be throwing up for the next half hour. Anyway, I just threw those out there, those two questions, and like I say,
but just to wrap things up real quick.
Yeah.
I'm looking for presidential candidates under 70. Actually, I'm looking for presidential candidates under 66.
Be a refreshing change of pace, wouldn't it?
Obama, Clinton, hell, W. It's not a lock or anything, but I can't get over the fact that a vigorous, rough and ready he-man like Ronald Reagan was dribbling his oatmeal by the time he was on the way out the door at 70, you know, what, 78?
Yeah.
He left the White House dribbling his oatmeal at an age 2 years younger than Bernie would be in the presidency.
Yeah,
and I get I have been accused of ageism on this. And no, that's bullshit. That's not ageism. Ageism is when you say that a person from the working class can't do a working class job simply because of their age. This ain't no working class job. Okay? This is the presidency of the United States. And frankly, at the tender age of almost 56, at the risk of being a hypocrite, it's the generation just ahead of me and the generation, my generation and the generation behind me's fucking turn. And that, you know, that's why I created that hashtag. It didn't go anywhere. Pass the damn torch.
Well, you've given me food for thought, and I've heard you talk about this issue of age for presidential candidates, if not presidents, and it is a concern because the job never gets easier. And you look, I mean, they show before and after pictures of them the day they were sworn in and pictures of them the day they leave, and it's a metamorphosis. It's like a Hollywood makeup person has had at them. And hell, fucking LBJ, that poor bastard.
Well, fuck, Barack Obama went from looking like Denzel Washington to looking like Ossie Davis.
I know, and along the way, he quit smoking. Like, that's going to help. I mean, you know, I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue, you know? So... anyway, I will let you go.
But, yeah, but all that having been said, I'm going to vote for my party's nominee. If my party's nominee is Bernie Sanders, I'm voting for Bernie Sanders in November.
Well, if Bernie does get the nomination, I hope he chooses wisely and effectively for his running mate. You know?
Yeah.
Whoever gets in, I hope they whoever's running as a candidate for my party. I sincerely hope that we have sense enough to get someone who can be elected without question, and that that person brings with him or her a second slot holder who's ready to step in to be just as good, if not better. You know, I think about this talk about, you know, what's going to come out of the Mueller investigation and what's going to come out of the new democratically controlled House of Representatives and the hearings and different things. And then I think further down the line that Trump may go bye-bye in the car before January 21st of 2021. And who do we got waiting in the wings? Pence, who looks for all the world like that blue-eyed, pale, blonde hit person in that Tom Hanks movie that was based on Dan Brown's book. I can't remember the damn film.
Oh, from the Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, Da Vinci Code, yeah. I saw that movie, and I had to, I would wake up screaming seeing that guy. And now we got to look at Pence, who is definitely no angel. He is a nefarious motherfucker, if I can use that word.
And I saw a video of him today, Scott, that made me laugh out loud.
Oh, no.
I don't do that a whole lot because... generally, Agnes comes running into the room and says, "Are you okay?"
well, granted, but Pence is not one to inspire hearty laughter.
So Julius Geezer walked out into the Rose Garden or what the hell ever.
Yeah.
And he's flanked and followed by Mike Pence. And when I was a little boy, 3 years old maybe.
Yeah.
And my parents just, because it was the early 1960s, mid-1960s, played roulette with my life. They didn't wear safety belts, and, well, you know, it wasn't much in the way of a car seat. So most of the time, I just stood on the bench seat of the Chrysler Newport between my mom and my dad with my little 3-year old hand on my dad's shoulder.
Yeah.
And my mom just ready to grab me at a moment's notice. But at one point in time, I had a little tiny steering wheel set so I could drive in the car.
I remember those.
And so my dad would be sitting there at the wheel and moving the wheel and turning, and I'm sitting over there to one side moving the wheel, and then, you know, he turns and I turn, and we turn, we go through the chicanes, and I thought immediately of that when I saw this video of Trump and Pence, because they come out into the Rose Garden, Pence is just behind him, and, you know, I had a little horn on the thing, meep, yeah. Dad was not one for the horn, so I didn't get much chance to use that.
Yeah.
But Trump walks out into the Rose Garden, reaches into his coat, and pulls out his speech. And Pence, behind him, reaches into his coat and pulls out nothing. And I immediately went, oh, my God, Trump's his daddy. He's doing what Daddy does.
I have a little shadow. It always follows me.
Precisely.
Yeah. Well, and he's, you know, he's a pleaser. Pence, well, he comes across as trying to be a pleaser. Pence does. You know, he's got to show the proper groveling and thankfulness.
Oh, I saw a picture of him swearing in Kristen Sinema the other day.
Ooh.
And, you know, she had herself sworn in on a law book because she's not just the first bisexual elected to the Senate. She's pretty well an agnostic, too.
I hope that, you know how in the horror movies when they're doing the exorcisms and the priest takes the thing and dips it in the holy water and sprinkles it on the object of the exorcism, and they say, it burns, it burns. You know, I hope that inside of Pence somewhere, there was a great deal of burning going on for heaven.
Well, the meme that I saw had him swearing her in, and the caption on the meme said, and she was wearing this, you know, sleeveless shell and a lovely skirt and, you know, with her serious person eyeglasses on, and had her hand over there, and the meme caption simply said, "Mother says you should be wearing sleeves." And that's the voice I heard it in. That sort of pinched, constipated. Mother says you should be wearing sleeves.
Yeah.
There Harlot.
Oh, it's going to be fun. Whatever happens the next 2 years, now that we've got some sanity in the House of Representatives, I just can't wait. I want them all to squirm, just to squirm mightily, Bob. I do, from Trump on down. I just, you know, and I don't...
Well, and that may be why he goes bye-bye in the car.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that remains a possibility. And you know they're beginning to sweat because, again, Rudy Giuliani was out there saying, well, we reserve the right to see the Mueller investigation before it's made public. Yeah, well, reserve in one hand and shit in the other and see which one fills up first there, rude boy.
Well, in terms of Trump going bye-bye in the car, Pence may have his own little steering wheel with little beep-beep horn to go along with him. Because we don't know what Mueller's going to come up with.
No, and you know what? The possibility remains that it may be, with regard to Trump himself, absolutely nothing. But I self-soothe in moments when I'm thinking things like that by remembering one simple phrase: Manafort chose Pence.
Yeah.
We're up to 5 felonies? 5 chargeable federal felonies?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And if he goes and says, listen, I got an indictment for you. I got an indictment for your boy. I got an indictment for your precious daughter. And I'm pretty sure you've seen some of those women in prison movies, Don, back in the 70s. What do you say you just quit? and nobody gets indicted.
He'll never quit. He'll never quit.
Well, that's what he says. Oh, I never settled cases. I've never settled a case. We're going to settle this, right? Yeah, I never settle cases except the ones I settle.
Well, yeah, there is that. But
he doesn't want to be the first president to go to prison. Hell, he doesn't want to be the first president to be booked. He's managed to buy his way out of a shit ton of legal trouble over the years.
Yeah.
But this may be one he can't buy his way out of.
Well, and maybe I'll have to rethink that. Maybe he would be inclined to quit because he certainly doesn't want to be the first one to go to jail, but he'd be only the second one to quit, a la Nixon. And maybe he can take Roger Stone with him, and they can just have a weep fest.
And see, as long as that indictment is under seal, there's not much he can do about it. And so, consequently, when he, I mean, even if Hot Tub Time Machine Whitaker tells him there's an indictment under seal, what's he going to do? Say unseal it? At that point in time, the Supreme Court kind of has to say, well, you know, you asked for it, bub.
Get your tickets early, friends. Get your popcorn popped and a comfortable seat because it's going to be a hell of a show. The Freak Parade is coming to your town. Don't you love it?
I might take a little Thorazine along the way, but I'm down for the ride.
It gives you a Thorazine drip, Bob. That's what you need on little wheels, and you can take it around with you as you go out and turn the meat on the barbecue.
Well, what I'm looking for is a Thorazine liqueur that you can put in a crockery jug with a loop handle up by the neck and stopper with a corn cob.
Well, there you go.
Just kind of lay it up on your shoulder like, and it's a good thing we don't do video here because I just put it up on my, I put my imaginary Thorazine jug up on my shoulder, took a swig.
Yeah. It'd be a great name for a band, Thorazine Jug.
No, the band name happened this weekend. Agnes showed me a year old story from I think the New York Times about a mutant species of crayfish.
I saw that.
A Zydeco punk band called Mutant Crayfish.
Mutant crayfish.
And they come on stage in crayfish costumes, and their names are Ribido, Thibodeau, Michaud, and Claude. Get it? Claude Crayfish. Yeah. And they've got and John on Facebook pointed out, he said, yeah, and they could be superheroes too, and they've got a taste for carry out po' boys.
I remember po' boys. Po' boys.
Teenage Mutant Crayfish. Ribido, Thibodeau, Michaud, and Claude.
You're twisted, Bob, but I like it.
Well, I thank you kindly, neighbor.
All right, man.
All right.
Take care now. Give my best to the family.
Yeah, keep the shiny side up and the dirty side down.
Yes, I'm just sitting there waiting for the UPS man to show up.
Hot diggity, high living. You getting your new heater?
No. They're bringing me some pipe tobacco.
Ah, very nice, very nice. Right.
One that I wanted to try for a long time was on sale, and so I got like an ounce of it. And
dude, I got an ounce.
And this is what my life has become, Bob. Here we've got legalized pot left, right, and center in the great state of California, and I'm ordering pipe tobacco. What the hell's wrong with me? But anyway, the flavor that I wanted, I got an ounce of, but I was reading the reviews, and some people were comparing it to an even better thing from another company, so I got an ounce of that, too. So I'm just going to be ounced up to the deuce.
Dude.
And it'll all be good, Bob.
It will.
It'll all be good.
It'll all work out.
All right, man. Take care.
All right. Later, Scott. Bye now.
All right, bud. See ya.
The one and only Scott in San Diego. By the way, Darlene in Connecticut points out, I'm telling you, Pence was using every excuse to linger around Kristen Sinema, who looked pretty hot in her Marilyn Monroe throwback look. He was talking slow and had her turn a certain way to take the oath. I've never seen an oath take that long to administer. I think Pence was milking the opportunity to be around her because Mother Pence couldn't stop him, as he had to administer the oath to do it. Oh, yeah. He really liked her, you know. Really, really. And then when he got home, Mother Pence was waiting for him with the wooden hairbrush. Michael, you've been a very bad, unchristian boy. You had dirty, dirty thoughts, didn't you, Michael?
Yes, Mother.
God, they're such a sick bunch. Mm-hmm. And she looked absolutely lovely. And I did notice that. No, turn this way. No, turn that way. And Senator Cinema kind of had this cat that swallowed the canary look on her face. Yeah. Huh, good question coming in from Irish Dave. Remind me, Bob. Say Drumpf is indicted by New York State. Does the statute of limitations clock pause when the indictee is out of the jurisdiction of the New York legal process? That is an unanswered question. If he was indicted by New York State while in office, the question of whether anybody can indict a sitting president would go up to the Supreme Court. But the statute of limitations would affect whether or not one can indict for... The statute of limitations itself doesn't limit what happens after the indictment is returned. It limits whether or not you can return an indictment within a set period of time, if that makes any sense. And I think it kind of does. Mark in Florida says, obstruction of justice. Hello, Pelosi. Oh, wouldn't that just make their heads collectively explode? I know, I think Tom Hartman posited this as an idea. And it seems kind of out there. But then again, I'm entertaining all manner of fantasy just to get myself personally past the madness. Because madness there is. It was earlier today that Julius Geezer said, "It gives me pleasure to announce that I will be making a national broadcast tomorrow." And all he's going to do is lie about the national, let's find out what exactly he said. Because it sort of impacts us here. I'm pleased to inform you that I will address the nation on the humanitarian and national security crisis on our southern border Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. And the question is, will the networks fall for it? Because earlier in the weekend, he was rage tweeting at the media, calling them the enemy of the state again. So as one editor or, you know, senior broadcast executive said, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. And the one thing that bugs them more than anything else, again, going back to what Matt was talking about, eyeballs. So if nobody covers it but Fox, that means Fox gets all the eyeballs. And that becomes a problem in its own right. Because remember, they are after, there's a reason we refer to them as the for-profit media. Oh, this is good. James in Illinois says, Roger Stone's whispering in his ear, "You're smarter than Nixon. You're better looking than Nixon. And you're luckier than Nixon." But yes, James also points out that the day that Mike Pencilneck Geek swore in Kristen Sinema, the Pences had some hot missionary that night. Oh, somebody get me the brain bleach. That just hurt a lot. We got about an hour left in the program and $250 left to raise to stay even with the beginning of the new week. It would be great if we could knock out, say, you know, the rest of that 100 or a little more. I wish there was a challenge on the table or something like that, but there isn't. So it's just a matter of trying to keep up and keep things going. And thank you so much for all you do to keep things going. If you want to engage in some conversation, you're more than welcome to. The numbers, of course, you know, unless you're a noob. And if you are, welcome aboard. 304-574-8178 or Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn. If you've never called that way, just send me a contact request and we'll be right at it. If you need us to pay the freight on the phone, call 844-843-4676, 844-THE-HORN, THEHORN. That gets you in, and the number that goes with that, if you don't need us to pay the toll charges, 304-640-2829. That's just too gross to even contemplate, Marty. If that's the case, someone needs to tell Senator Kyrsten Sinema to watch where she showers. Remember when Mother Norman Bates went after Marion Crane? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Ooh. Full body shudder. Meanwhile, Silent R. Lamar says, on the impeachment, I'm waiting for Trump to force the Republicans to remove him, claiming a false state of emergency is a start. And there is stuff out there, if you want to go and read it, what a declaration of a national emergency could and would do. It's a pretty scary damn list. But we all know the man has dictatorial impulses and that he loves authoritarian dictators above all others. That's why we refer to him, among other things, as Julius Caesar. Right. Yeah. All right. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program. What's happening?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's up?
It's Dave from Tallahassee.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Much better. We had a memorial party for Mom Saturday.
Good.
It was beautiful, man. She wanted us all to get together and have a good time, make some memories, and have good food. And we did. And let me tell you, my sister whipped out this cherry cobbler wine.
Whoa.
Oh, that stuff is wicked. Ooh.
That's it. Yeah.
I heard you talk about the idiot at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is wanting to declare national emergency.
He's been threatening to do it, and I don't know that martial law goes with it, but there are a host of things that go with that. But the problem is, there's no national emergency.
Yeah, I don't see any massive outbreak of a deadly disease or anything.
We're not under attack. The national emergency is that people are catching on to his bullshit, I guess.
Well, you know, if that's the case, then he ought to open up the fertilizer business.
But the larger issue here, Dave, is, and this came out over the weekend, the whole reason he started talking that wall bullshit was because his campaign advisors back in 16 couldn't figure out a way to keep him focused enough to talk about the actual issues. He'd go out in front of a crowd and start grunting and scratching and be off down the garden path talking about who knows what. So they came up with this idea of having him talk about a border wall so that he would remember to talk about immigration so that he could get the maggots all head up over one of their favorite groups of people upon whom to hate. So the wall itself never was a real thing. It was just something that got completely out of hand.
And now my brother-in-law, my sister's husband, who's a mail carrier, is paying for it because he's working like a slave for slave wages, meaning he ain't getting paid until they get all this shit straightened out. Oh, good God.
Voted for Trump, did he?
No. No.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
My sister's like me from the liberal wing of the family. She's a good union teacher, and all that applies. My brother is coming around. I had to school him on what unions actually did. His boss has been doing some anti-union education. But they've been working him weird hours and long hours. When he tries to get an explanation as to why the schedule is the way it is, well, that's the way it is. That's the way we're going to do it. Well, Bob's finally asking questions, and I said, you know what? They probably got you down as a union organizer. Because all the stuff they've been doing is illegal under the Labor Relations Act, you know. So,
yeah. Jesus.
I mean, this is Taliban, yeah, man. This is, you know, and it's all over. I mean, you hear Republicans like Roy Moore saying, "Oh, we want to go back to 1820." Well, yeah. Well, it's not just black folks they want to put back in 1820. They want to put everybody back in 1820. And as long as they're getting their peace, they don't give a shit. But,
of course,
yeah,
not.
That's a mess. I went, like I said, I went home over the weekend for Mom's memorial dinner and spent a couple of days at Mom's house, which was kind of weird with her not being there. But, I got a lot out of my system, and it was good. So, well, Bob, I'll let you go. And
I'm glad things went well, Dave, and I thank you for updating us.
Yeah, it really went well, and if I had thought about it, I'd invite the whole congregation to help, but my sister would benefit. But so. I'll talk to you later, Bob.
All right, you take care, Dave. Later now.
Bye.
Buddy Dave from Talibandiana. News came out earlier today. Well, it's not really news now, is it? The executive director of the Georgia State Ethics Commission has been stone cold busted with porn on his computer. We don't necessarily know what kind of porn, but is anyone really surprised? I would have been surprised if there wasn't porn on his computer. I don't know for a fact the guy's a Republican, but I think one may safely infer that he is. There will be an emergency session of the State Ethics Commission tomorrow to decide whether to remove Stephen Ritter, who's been the executive director there since 2015, for misuse of state computers. Yeah. It used to be the Georgia Government Transparency and Campaign Finance Commission, but that was that was just too wordy. And they never did much in the way of it anyway. Stephen Ritter had been 18 years with the Georgia Attorney General's office when he got tapped to be executive director of the Ethics Commission. Yeah. It hasn't been a particularly high-quality outfit, but, I mean, come on. Can't we cut a poor Republican some slack? It wasn't like he had much to do there anyway. Note coming from Arnold, our last president, Trump, he will never not be president. He'll find an excuse to not have elections. Obama signed that national emergency law, and Trump can just take it over by normalcy. I hope you're wrong, Arnold. I sincerely hope you're wrong. The Attorney General of Alabama has weighed in on the story that Matt Osborne told us about. Attorney General Steve Marshall, who, of course, is a good, God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, Christian Republican, is calling for federal election officials to look into the experiments that took place in Alabama in 2017. Mike Lewis, a spokesperson for the Attorney General of Alabama, said, "The Attorney General's office has evaluated reports of possible deception in the Alabama U.S. Senate race and has determined the matter to be under the exclusive jurisdiction of the U.S. Federal Election Commission. Accordingly, the Attorney General has requested that FEC officials investigate the matter to determine if any federal laws were violated." They were just ads. That's all they were. They didn't say they were done on behalf of. It's just an advocacy group called Dry Alabama. If anything, I'm surprised that the organization didn't already exist. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty nice punt for the Alabama Attorney General. Since we're probably going to hear a lot about the wall tomorrow, I guess I have to watch it. It's going to come on at 9 Eastern Standard Time somewhere, probably everywhere. That means this program will have just completed, and so consequently, that means that I will have no excuse. But he'll blather away about the humanitarian crisis. The only reason there's a humanitarian crisis is because, if there is one, is because they deliberately slowed down the processing at the ports of entry, they being the Trump regime, and because the government is in a shutdown, which means that people ain't getting paid. But there's a new bit of information out about the wall that Julius Geezer wants. Fact of the matter is, there's already a good bit of fence and stuff like that running from basically just south of San Diego to the boot heel and a little further into New Mexico. But the southern border of the state of Texas, and I'm sure you already know this, is defined by the Rio Grande River. And it is that stretch of border where they want to build the wall. To be precise, there are 1,254 miles of border along the Rio Grande as it meanders down toward Brownsville. And I don't have any real familiarity with that area. It's beautiful. I know that. But, and perhaps I could have inferred some of this with some of the things that our buddy John Britovo has talked about with the flooding he's dealt with there on the Nueces River. But the Rio Grande floods bigly, to quote the President of the United States. And it does so fairly frequently. Over the last several years, as a result of climate change, it's taken to flooding more. In the National Climate Assessment, they noted that record-breaking flooding events increased over the past 30 years in what they call the Southern Great Plains, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas. The National Climate Assessment also said that the flooding's going to get worse. And because it's a river, it has this geographical feature to it called a floodplain, which means that it's an area where when the river gets out of its banks, that area of seemingly dry land becomes inundated a lot. So, and there's really no guessing involved. Guess what's going to happen when it floods and the wall is there? Well, it's either going to make the flooding worse, or the multi-billion-dollar boondoggle is just going to get swept downriver, because Trump's a stable, very stable genius. Here's something I didn't know. There's even a treaty. It was signed in 1970, ratified by both countries, Mexico and the United States. The Treaty to Resolve Pending Boundary Differences and Maintain the Rio Grande and Colorado River as the International Boundary. It creates the Joint U.S.-Mexico International Boundary and Water Commission. And it says that before any construction can take place on the river, that commission, quote, must approve construction of works proposed in either country. And if a project in the judgment of the commission might cause deflection or obstruction of the normal flow of the river or its flood flows, it's illegal according to treaty. So that's going to go to court, too. And this dumbass boondoggle will be either a dam or flotsam. Let's see here. 2008, there was a flash flood. And there was a 5-mile border fence along the Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument in Arizona. Reporting there by the Arizona Daily Star noted that the fence became a dam during the flash flood that year. And water that ordinarily went north-south, well, it flowed east-west instead. Quote from the Daily Star, a wash directly west of Lukeville flowed more than 200 feet along the fence and through the port of entry at the international border, causing flood damage to private property, government offices, and businesses. And that was a fairly small event. Might want to point out along the way that floods along the Rio Grande are visible from space. They're that big. And of course, it's not going to be right along the river. It's going to alienate a whole bunch of American property because, you can't build it in Mexico without invading. Never a dull moment. All right, let's run back over to the phones and check in. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Bob, can you hear me?
Yeah, is this Megan?
Yeah, this is Megan. My phone's been acting weird. That's why I've been asking. I tried calling in on the other lines, but it rang once, and I got a weird message about you have a voicemail box that hasn't been set up yet, and then it hung up on me.
That's odd. The phone shut itself down for some reason.
Okay. I have something I've been dying to ask you, and it's not Trump related and it's not wall related.
Okay.
But
now you've made me nervous.
Well, you were born and bred and lived your life in West Virginia, correct?
No, I was born in Alabama to West Virginia parents.
Okay. But it's okay.
But I've been coming here all of my life, and I've lived here since 1983.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you something, because the movie was on New Year's Day. I wanted to ask you about what you knew about the Hatfields and McCoys feud.
I know stuff. What do you want to know?
The reason I ask is because I'm curious. I really like the TNT movie with, I think it's Bill Pullman and Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
And a bunch of other stars were in it. They showed it New Year's Day, and I've been meaning to ask you because I was curious about the history behind it, whether the movie followed the history, because we know that doesn't always happen.
It seldom does, and I don't recall seeing the movie. I may have seen snippets of it.
Uh-huh.
But it was a bloody affair. It certainly captured the attention of organizations like the New York Times, who happily used it to sell papers and promote the idea that Appalachia was filled with ignorant, barbarian, bloodthirsty hillbillies. In fact, that's where a lot of the modern-day stereotyping comes from.
Wow, I didn't know that. I actually, when I did research online, I came across a blog of someone who allegedly was like, I don't know, part of the family tree and lived her life there.
Oh, God, you go down there, everybody and their cousins related to him.
Is that true, or is that just something they say, or could that well be true?
Oh, no, huge extended families. I mean, by the time the 1920s rolled around, there's a Governor Hatfield in West Virginia who was a, you know, part of the Klan. Not the Klan, but that Klan.
Hatfield?
Yeah, it's a Hatfield. The Hatfields are in West Virginia. The McCoys are on the Kentucky side. I mean, I've got a dear friend that has worked in the 8th campaign with us in the past. Another direct descendant, and he's a McCoy.
Wow. Well, my question is, someone in this blog pointed out some interesting differences in the movie and postulated that actually the two families were, like, already interrelated by the time the feud happened, and that they said that the federal government at the time was trying to make them feud because they were trying to get a hold of the timber rights. And I thought that was an interesting angle that doesn't get – it certainly didn't get put in the movie, and it doesn't get discussed amount. And I wanted to ask you if you thought that was the case, or if that's an open secret.
I don't know that it's an open secret. It would not surprise me. It would not surprise me if timber was some sort of natural resources extraction was part of it. I'm just checking the relevant time frame here real quick.
It started just after the Civil War, according to the movie.
And I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that wraps into this. That area of Appalachia in the years immediately following the Civil War, and particularly in Kentucky, went on to just be a blood-soaked field of murder because people were getting vengeance for things that were done during the war. And people quite often got away with it. Let's see.
Yeah,
I'm trying to find out here. 1863 to 1891, basically. And so what's happening toward the latter part of that is that Appalachia is being opened up for resource extraction, and the place was timbered out for all it was worth to support both the construction of railroads and the construction of mining. This is at the same time that corporate lawyers and land agents are traversing Appalachia and carrying with them something called the broad form deed. And what they'd do is they'd show up at some mountaineer's cabin. Most of the time, he's probably illiterate. And they'd explain to him that he could keep his land and use it higher he wanted to for as long as he wanted to, and all he was a-doing was a-selling off the minerals. And he wasn't a-using them no how.
So what became of that if they signed away their...
Well, he signed away his mineral rights, and then, of course, the company had all the rights to do whatever they wanted to do with the land in order to extract the minerals that they had bought fair and square. And so people were forced off of lands that they'd lived on, their families had lived on for 100 years or more. They were impoverished into a form of slavery to the coal companies, not a form of slavery, but that's the wrong word to use. But they were driven off of their land and into the clutches of the tender mercies of the coal industry. And they were then not even paid in real American money. They were paid in company scrip and kept in a form of persistent and unending tenancy debtor status.
Wow. Now that you mention all that, how much is going that into the present day circumstances of West Virginia being a mono economy
it's the reason it is, and the same thing for Eastern Kentucky and Southwest Virginia. We don't own our minerals here. The minerals were severed from this place 100 years ago or more. Very few people living in West Virginia own the minerals under their ground. And so if for instance, a pipeline company wants to come through and completely wreck your land to put in one of their toxic, dangerous, one of these days going to blow to kingdom come pipelines, they can, and you can't do a damn thing about it. And it's happening now. It's happening right now.
Is that related to eminent domain like you were talking about earlier?
Well, sometimes you don't even need eminent domain because, well, damn it, they own the minerals.
Oh, jeez. See, I had no idea about any of that. I was just curious about the story, and I figured you live in West Virginia, you knew history, but apparently there's a whole lot more going into that feud than is being presented, because they play up the personal dramas, the interrelational stuff, but there's some stuff in there. If you watch the movie and pay attention, that there's whole lot of politics and stuff going in there. You probably don't catch a whole lot unless you're paying attention.
Because there was
one point.
Now, one of the more interesting aspects of the feud is the fact that I told you a lot of people took a lot of vengeance for what had gone on in the Civil War. Well, both the Hatfields and the McCoys were largely Confederate. They both fought on the Confederate side.
I thought someone was saying in the chat room one side supported the Union, the other side supported the Confederacy.
No, the first man killed was, I think, if I recall correctly, he was an outlier in the McCoy clan insofar as he had actually fought for the Union.
Well, that's how the movie started, and that's how they paint the whole feud being started, was that Harmon McCoy was in the Union. And he was making his way home after the Civil War, and Jim Vance, who was a Hatfield, he was like a great uncle or uncle of Devilance Hatfield, caught sight of him in a bar, and he got all pissed off because they supported the Confederacy, and he got his, you know, there's a men were exchanging words in a bar, and he got angry, and one of them tried to leave, and then Harmon McCoy had to basically remove himself to a cabin to keep his family safe and lie low for a while, but they found him at the cabin anyway and killed him, and that's what led their daughter, Nancy, was later, she was really pissed about that, and she later was painted as being a spy and marrying a Hatfield, and when the McCoy bounty hunters were hunting down Hatfields, she's basically, she had married one of the Hatfield sons and was basically telling the bounty hunters where they were. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. In the movie, it's painting a lot of stuff that I just was scratching my head over, like, wait a minute, because they say showing that started like it when everyone was coming home from the Civil War, but you're telling me there was a lot of stuff that happened during the Civil War, because you also
well, if you really want a good understanding, particularly of Eastern Kentucky, in that relevant time frame, I highly recommend to you a book called "Night Comes to the Cumberland." Night Comes to the Cumberlands by Harry Caudill.
Okay.
And
Caudill.
Bingo.
Okay.
It's heartbreaking to read, but it's factual. And he goes through and explains that period of time when it was just the Wild West has nothing on late 19th century Appalachia. It was truly a lawless place. Vicious. Bloody. Hateful. And the fact that anybody survived it is a minor miracle.
Yeah, they did show that in the movie, too. That was one of the things that kind of impressed upon me, is that there was a lot of Wild West elements or themes in that. It definitely showed that people were following their own customs, and that whatever laws regarding Washington, D.C. were very far away and not really relevant to what they were dealing with. Like, the only time you got anywhere close to it is when the McCoy bounty hunters, there was issue of legality of them hunting the Hatfields, and Devilance got, like, he was communicating with some representative of the governor of their state, and he was basically like, y'all better start, you know, putting your hands in this and sorting out this mess, because it could be another civil war between two states. But it really didn't get into the whole politics of the situation, but yeah, it really looked like well, I was going to say it really looked like it was sort of being settled, but it wasn't. It didn't really look like there were any established laws at the time, that they were still trying to figure out their own way.
But you see that Wild West environment. You always, any situation like that, you always ask the question: cui bono? Who benefits? And it benefited the coal companies and the timber companies to have no real law in the area, because that meant that they became a law unto themselves. And so if there was a sheriff, it was a sheriff that the company approved of. If there was a town marshal or a town cop, it was somebody that had been approved by the company. So by the time you get to 1919, 1920, and Matewan in West Virginia, the reason that gun battle takes place is because the town of Matewan was an independent town. It wasn't company-owned, and they had an independent sheriff, a guy named Two-Gun Sid Hatfield.
Wow.
Who went toe-to-toe with the Baldwin thugs who were trying to evict miners for trying to organize for better wages and living conditions.
Wow, I had no idea about any of this.
It's almost like a hidden history in the United States.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Why isn't this discussed more? Because there's a whole underlying...
Because if you start teaching this stuff, Megan, people are liable to take it seriously and begin to understand what capitalism has done to this country over the years. The first coal miners in Appalachia weren't poor whites like my ancestors. The first coal miners in Appalachia were slaves who were driven underground by slave owners. The coal industry began on the backs of slaves, just like everything else that happened in this country.
So how did it turn over to... how did it turn over to the poor white?
Because the Civil War came along. And...
Wow.
Right.
You see, you don't hear about the slaves working the mines. You hear them working on the fields.
Right, but... Well, at least that's been... Coal wasn't highly exploited before the Civil War.
So it was mostly cotton?
Depending on where you were. If you were in Virginia, North Carolina, Kentucky, it was tobacco. As you move down into places like Tennessee, it's hemp. There were vast, vast hemp plantations because this country had especially the military, had a ceaseless need for hemp. Like the Navy, for ropes, for sailing ships. And then as you move down into the in South Carolina, rice and indigo. And when you move into Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and Arkansas and Texas, cotton.
Georgia?
Cotton.
Cotton?
Yeah.
Well, that's giving me a lot to think about, Bob.
And, you know, West Tennessee cotton. So when the slave economy collapses, it has to be replaced, and the broad form deed comes along. The coal companies steal all the land, and then they've got a ready-made supply of labor who will have to work for whatever the company says they'll pay, or else they starve to death. This is also a period of time when you begin to see a westward exodus out of Appalachia. Families going west, which usually meant to Ohio or Indiana. Some of them went so far west that they wound up in Oregon. One of my distant relatives was a member of the Oregon, and this was years, decades ago, either a senator or a member of the House of Representatives of the state of Oregon for years.
Yeah, that got presented in the movie. I'm surprised they didn't discuss Texas being the next frontier, because it kind of seemed like that was a time frame that Texas...
The settlement of Texas happens a little bit differently. But I tell you what, if you, and it's fiction, it's a novel, but because it's based on a certain reality, there was a novel written around the turn of the century called The Trail of the Lonesome Pine.
Mm-hmm.
The author, it was a journalist, a Harvard-educated journalist from Kentucky by the name of John Fox Jr., and he writes this romance. It's a romance. It's a romance novel. But it all centers on the exploitation of the southwest tip of Virginia for the coal fields and the coming of the railroad and what they hoped would be a booming steel industry. And the romance in it is kind of creepy because, well, I'll just leave it for you. It's Appalachia. But it is a brilliant exposition of the land and culture, and there's feud culture in there too, of the time, because the guy who wrote it was a journalist and B knew that section of country.
And you can get it.
I'm pretty sure you can get it for free on Kindle.
Okay, I have to look that up. That's wow, Bob. You've given me a lot to think about. Thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Megan.
I knew you were the person to ask. I just I saw the movie. If you see the TNT version, it's probably the most recent. I just didn't know if you know. I was watching.
I usually take a powder on those because I wind up getting pissed off because it's usually done in some way that makes us look like goddamn fools, idiots, hicks, rubes. My mother, for instance, despised the so-called classic Hollywood film Sergeant York because it made it made Alvin York's mother sound like she was somehow mentally deficient.
Yes and no. I mean, Kevin Costner played Dev Lance Hatfield, and to be quite honest, he was actually a very savvy businessman. Just because of the fact that he came across as very shrewd. They made Randall McCoy, and this somehow didn't get brought up, but he was kind of a, I want to say a hard-ass evangelical, but it got brought up in the blog that he may have been suffering from PTSD because he was a Confederate prisoner of war until the war ended before he came home. And that's why Devil Ants kind of let his antics go for a bit because he knew he was suffering. I don't know what they called it back then. I guess the battle heart or something. I forget what the term was.
Huh? Tetched.
What?
Tetched.
Tetched?
T-E-C-H-E-D. Touched.
Ah.
Tetched, oh. Tetched in the Hade.
Yeah. Yeah, he was suffering from that because of the war, and up until his brother Ellison was killed, and that's when he really started putting his foot down. But I don't have that perspective because I didn't grow up or am familiar with the area, and I was kind of I wanted to ask someone who was to see hey, what's your opinion of it? But I mean, that's just my perspective. They kind of look like they come. They definitely look and act like they come from that area, but it didn't really appear to me like they were all that stupid. It was more like a different kind of smarts, maybe not necessarily book smart, but they knew their stuff for the area and time that they were in. Does that make sense?
Well, they managed to survive, so they can't have been too stupid.
Well, yeah.
But then again, my ancestors came here. One group in what, 1746, 47, and they were highly literate and well educated, and that family was illiterate within two generations.
Hmm.
Because
why
when
was
you're
that?
Well, because you don't one, there's not a lot of books. And two, when you're carving out an existence on the very last dry rotted thread of a shoestring, there's not a lot of time for such luxuries as sitting around and reading.
No, that's true.
Because all your time goes to survival.
Right. Right. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting. In particular, they said that the Hatfields and McCoys were already friendly, or they were already family, or they were already blood related at the time of the feud, and that it had really been stoked by the government's trying to get a hold of the timber rights.
I'm really skeptical about that because the government, the government wasn't going after timber rights; it was private concerns.
Hmm. But the private concerns were, how deeply were they in the pocket of the federal government? I mean, we're talking about present day, and we know the answer to that, but I mean, it's interesting that all this history we're discussing now is looking like it really laid the groundwork for what we're dealing with, what, 200, 300, 200
there's not a day that later. There's not a day that goes by in Appalachia, Megan, where we do not still feel the echoes down the decades and the centuries of the abuses to which people here were subjected so long ago that most people here don't even know about it or who their ancestors were. I just happen to know about mine.
Wow. All right. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Megan. Always a pleasure.
You
take care.
Bye. Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
That's our buddy, Megan. Warrior Witch in the chat room. A little bit of time left in the program, about 15 minutes or so. And we are still trying to get down past $250 to go, so we're not looking at $450 tomorrow. Hopefully that will, heck, if we could knock out $50 now, or 10, you know, five people at $10, or you know, five new subscribers even. You know, if you go to HeadOn.live, man, it's hard to miss that PayPal button. I'm sorry to have to, you know, talk about it, but that's how it works out. What else? Because we got lots of morans. Lots and lots of morans for this Moran Monday. There's a bit of a I guess you would say a celebrity. It's not celebrity so much. Well, let's put it this way. There's a young man in West Virginia, all of 19 years old. His name's Caleb Hanna. Sounds like something out of the Hatfields and McCoys, doesn't it? Caleb Hanna. He comes from Webster County, West Virginia. And he is the youngest African-American in the United States to be elected to a state legislature. When the West Virginia legislature sits here later this month, he is something of a sensation. He's a freshman in college at West Virginia's historically black university, West Virginia State University. And he just decided he wanted to be a member of the legislature. He wanted to have a political future, so by God, he ran for office. It would be a real feel-good story if it didn't have a punchline. He tells the Charleston Gazette-Mail about all the excitement around his election. He said, "I got calls from the governor, the secretary of state, all kinds of constituents. Million things were running through my head. I didn't even have a statement prepared." He was inspired to get involved in politics. He said, "I first got involved in interested in politics in the third grade. Here was this charismatic black man who rose to be the president of the United States. I thought, I can do that." The punchline is that he ran and won as a Republican. No shit. And so the GOP will catapult him to stardom in short order. As the Gazette writes, "President Obama's policies did not sit well with the son of a coal miner. My dad got laid off in the mines. I felt Obama's policies were bad for West Virginia." So in other words, he ain't that smart. because he believed the Obama war on coal, EPA war on coal line of unmitigated horseshit that was pumped out by the GOP. And he fell for it. Describing his political philosophy, he said, "God, guns, and babies. That pretty much sums up my political philosophy." He's a firm defender of the Second Amendment rights and the rights of the unborn. This guy is going to get absolutely, like I said, catapulted to right-wing stardom. And what should be a good, you know, a great story, a feel-good story about a young person getting... Uh-uh. Just another Republican out there spewing crap that demonstrably isn't true. Oh, let's see. What else is we? It's a little time. Really can't... take a deep dive into much of anything. But that doesn't mean there's nothing. Oh, there were some legal doings in D.C. today. The Russian firm that was indicted by Robert Mueller, Concord is the name of the company, went into court to argue against the indictment of the company. And presented the court with a motion to dismiss. A lawyer by the name of Eric Dubelier, or perhaps Dubelier, got taken out to the woodshed by Judge Dabney Friedrich. And I don't know if Billable Rick is listening or Steve from New York, but you're going to giggle mightily if you are. Because, you know, when you go into federal court in D.C. defending a corporate client, even a Russian one, you're generally going to be presumed to come from a pretty tony law firm that's going to have pretty high standards. Well, Eric Dubelier went into court today and filed and argued a motion to dismiss. And cited as at least one of his authorities for the dismissal, wait for it, no really, Animal House. First he cites Lord Acton. Everything secret degenerates, even the administration of justice. Nothing is safe that does not show how it can bear discussion and publicity. In the special counsel's secret pleading, he concedes he took investigative action relating to information that was identical to that which defendant provided to firewall counsel just 7 days earlier. The special counsel states that he did not obtain the information from firewall counsel. The special counsel also states that if simply trusting him that everything is just peachy is not sufficient. Don't use peachy. He can tell more ex parte secrets to the court to support his position. The special counsel's argument is reminiscent of Otter's famous line, "Flounder, you can't spend your whole life worrying about your mistakes. You fucked up. You trusted us. Hey, make the best of it." At which point, the federal judge looked at Eric Dubelier and said, "Knock it off." At which point, Dubelier said that he had to consult with his client because the judge had accused him of unprofessional conduct. And then accused the judge of being biased against him, I guess, for being a fucking moron. Moran. At which point Dubelier said, you've personally attacked me. And the judge said, well, you personally attacked Mueller's office.
Well, I was just telling the truth, Your Honor.
Jesus. Again, this is one of those Russian outfits that, of course, did absolutely nothing. Again, that would be Concord Management and Consulting. It has to do with the Russian troll farm. But again, far too many people are willing to think it doesn't exist, no matter how much hard evidence there is of it.
Mother Russia would never do something like that. No, never, never.
And then finally, because Moran Monday, we welcome Sinclair Broadcasting to a Moran Monday nomination. WOAI-TV, which recently broadcast something called Full Measure. And it was produced by an anti-vaxxer by the name of Cheryl Atkinson. She bailed out of CBS after 21 years because she said CBS had a liberal bias. And so Sinclair Broadcasting ran this piece of fantastic garbage, leading Dr. David Gorski to ask, the real question is why At News 4SA is running anti-vax propaganda from a longtime anti-vax crank as news. And also, when leaving CBS, she sued them. And back in 2017, her lawsuit was bounced out on its ear. Because Moran. And SA, San Antonio. Great. We just had an 8-year-old boy, Felipe Alonso Gomez, say his name, die of flu while in United States captivity. And Sinclair is running anti-vax horseshit. Not inspiring. Not at all. So, it's time to get out of here. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Wait, obligatory Star Trek reference. Lee in New York says, howdy, Bob. I know that McCoy served on the Enterprise. Where did Hatfield serve? Hell, he was probably a Romulan. Thanks, everybody, for joining in. Thank you again so very, very much to to Catherine for jumping in and being the lone contributor this evening. Thank you so much, Catherine. Tomorrow we'll be dealing with a $450 fundraising goal, unless it comes down overnight, and it's entirely possible it could. Thanks to all of you who share your precious finite time engaged in this ongoing conversation. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks in the chat room this evening to Sparky and Steve. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thanks, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.